You've probably heard the term theism. I probably should have put it up on a slide, but you've heard the term theism. Theism means a belief in a God. It's a belief in a God. Technically, theism is a belief in a higher power, belief in some kind of transcendent reality beyond this world. But in a general sense, how we use the term in our culture today, theism is a belief in an ultimate creator, God, an all-powerful, all-knowing God. We call this kind of theism monotheism, belief in one all-powerful, all-knowing God. I got a slide there, Kevin, for the people. Yeah, there's theism there. There you can see the word there. And you can see that there are many monotheistic faiths in the world today. Christianity is one of them, but there's also Islam and Judaism. But this list also includes Sikhism, Zoroastrianism, an old ancient Persian faith that still has practitioners in Iran today. Baha'i is a monotheistic faith, and there are other smaller ones I could list as well. But there's another kind of theism at play in the world, a theism that believes there's multiple higher powers, multiple gods, belief in many gods, and the most obvious example of this today is Hinduism, which has a panoply of gods. This belief in many gods is also found in the ancient Greek religion and in the ancient Roman religion. The ancient Egyptians were polytheists. So were the Norse. We call this form of theism polytheism. And you know, there are still vestiges of this ancient polytheistic religion today in our culture. Like, think of the days of the week. Tyr day. You know, Tyr, the god of war in Norse mythology, is the underlying form for Tuesday. Tuesday is Tyr's day. Thor's day is the day named after the god of thunder, Thor. Freytag is the goddess, a Norse goddess, and it's her name that we take Friday from. So, you know, the Norse gods are still with us in our language. And, you know, the months of the year, too, they come from the Roman gods. Janus, the goddess Janus is the name for January. March is named after Mars. Julius Caesar gives us the name July, Augustus Caesar. Both who were considered gods ultimately by the Romans adorn the names of July and August for us. I mean, it's interesting how these ancient religions still shape our experience today. Now, admittedly, there are some religions that don't fall easily into either bucket, theism or polytheism. I think of Buddhism. Doesn't really fit into that bucket so easily. And there are some native religions as well who don't really fit into that binary of polytheism and monotheism. And there are, of course, those who don't believe there is any form of higher power at play in the world. We call those atheism, or atheists, or the belief in no belief in higher power, atheism. An assertion that there are no gods, there is no God. Now, most people who are raised in the West are still nominally theistic. Most people in the West believe in some kind of higher power. I think we could refine that a bit further. We could say that most people in the West are still at their heart monotheists. They believe in a unity or oneness of this higher power at play in reality. And you know, it's interesting. We don't have to turn to religion to know something about the God who's at work in the universe. We can say quite a bit about God without having to turn to any religious texts or any religious traditions. We can infer quite a bit about God by the way the universe is. Since our universe had a definite beginning, we call it the Big Bang. See, that's not just a TV show, right? It's a name for the moment when the universe came into existence. Scientists are pretty universally agreed that the universe began at a moment, a long time ago, 13.7 billion years ago, they estimate. And that universe had a beginning, which means there has to be a first cause for this beginning. It didn't just arise out of nothing. Nothing can come from nothing. That means that this first cause, who we call God, must have existed outside the universe that we know. And that means God is timeless and spaceless and immaterial. Because time, space, and material are all the things that come from the universe itself. And if God lived before the universe, God existed before the universe, then it means God can't be the very thing that the universe is made up of. And we think about the vastness of the universe. You know, the more we discover, the bigger it gets. There are now an estimate of 500 billion galaxies out there. It keeps growing bigger and bigger. Some cosmologists say there's a trillion galaxies in the universe today, each one made up of about 100 billion stars. That means God must be incredibly powerful to create such a vast and amazing universe. The sheer magnitude of the universe points to an incredibly powerful creator. And we know that God must have immense intelligence because the multitude of parameters that allow for the existence of the universe and a universe that can give life are so finely tuned that it borders on the miraculous. We're talking about an exquisite level of precision in the fundamental realities of the universe. An exquisite precision that goes beyond anything human beings could do, beyond anything human beings could even imagine being done. And we know God is a personal agent because once there was nothing and now there's something. When something comes into existence, it comes into existence through a decision. God made a decision to create, and now we are the beneficiaries of that decision. God is a personal agent. So we can infer a lot about God without any reference to religion at all. That's why I think most people today around the world believe in some kind of higher power, God. They may not be able to explain it in philosophical terms or in theological terms, but that deep intuition lives powerfully alive in people's hearts today, all over the world. It's when we go to that monotheistic bucket. You want to put that slide up there, Kevin. That one that, you know, has Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Sikhism, a whole bunch of other possible religions we could put in there. It's when we go and look at the specific claims that the various religions assert about God, it's there that sometimes people become a bit uneasy. It's playing in that sandbox that people find difficult. As long as we live at the generic level of about God, we're fine. It's when we dial down a bit further that people can struggle. And it's a funny thing that there are no churches or temples out there that worship God at the generic level. Considering that this generic understanding is probably the most comfortable place for people in our culture to live today, maybe not in every culture, but in our culture to live today, you think there would be churches or temples or communities of faith all over the place that worship the generic God without any reference to any specific teachings, a God that we infer simply from the way the universe works. You think there'd be lots of these kinds of churches or temples or faith communities around, but there really aren't any. I think there are mainline denominations that have in the past 50 years aspired to be this kind of faith community. We might call what we might call a post-Christian faith community, a church, post-Christian church, a church that celebrates the generic congregation. I think there are a lot of United Church congregations that in the secretness of their hearts would prefer to be a generic church that worships a generic God. It's interesting that these congregations are dying off very quickly. It seems that the worship of a generic God is not really feasible in the world that we live in spite of many wishing it were otherwise. Have you noticed that there's no such thing as ice cream, per se? You noticed that before? There's no such thing as ice cream. You can't go to a store and buy ice cream by itself. It's not in its generic form, at least. Have you ever had generic ice cream? I suspect very few of you have. Maybe no one has had generic ice cream. It's always ice cream with a flavor. Have you noticed that? It's always ice cream. It's vanilla ice cream. That seems pretty generic, but it's still a flavor, right? And there's chocolate ice cream, and then there's Tiger Stripes ice cream, bubblegum ice cream, mint chocolate chip ice cream. I like that one especially. Yeah. But there's never just generic ice cream. Why do you think that is? Well, I think there's no generic ice cream for sale in the parlor, the ice cream parlor you go to, or in the supermarket. Well, I think it's because no one would buy it. I think generic ice cream on its own is pretty bland tasting. Probably wouldn't taste very good. And it seems to be the same for God. You need flavoring to make it work. You need a Christian flavor or a Muslim flavor or a Jewish flavor or a Sikh flavor or whatever kind of flavor it might be, but you need some kind of flavoring to make this understanding of God work. And there's a certain kind of irony in this. The very thing that people need most when it comes to talking and understanding God, that specific flavor, is the very thing that people struggle the most with, it seems. Now, some people try to get around this by taking a little bit of understanding and wisdom from a variety of sources. You know, I'll take a little bit of Christianity, and I'll take a little bit of Islam, and I'll take a little bit of Sikhism and Judaism, and I'll mash it up with some Buddhist practices or New Age wisdom, and then we get this beautiful composite creation. Have you ever done that with ice cream? I one time went to an event that had like 6 flavors of ice cream. So I took a little bit of each and put it into my bowl and I stirred it up. What do you think it tasted like? It wasn't as good as I thought it would be. I thought I'd get these 6 rich flavors all mingled together. It was actually kind of bland and unsavory at all. I had that experience when I was doing a dish at one point, and I put in 6 different spices into it, very distinct spices, and I thought I would get this rich, wonderful flavor in what I was making, but when it was done, it didn't taste very good. You know, we can create our own composite religion on the snippets from a variety of sources, but what we end up with is often not theism. We don't end up with a deeper, richer understanding of the higher power of who God is. What we typically end up with is meism. I got another slide there. You know, the tension is we end up with meism, a worship of me. Because the tendency in us is to create God in our own image. In this scenario, it's inevitable that God will be very much like the person who's thinking about God. My God is going to look a lot like me, and your God is going to look a lot like you. And this composite religious approach is very popular today, people. And often, not always, but often it ends up being a worship of self, the worship of me. And I think meism today is rampant in our culture. It's everywhere. The elevation of the self seems to be about everywhere and everything in life today. And I want to talk more about meism next week, but I do want to point out to you that meism, me creating God in my own image and you creating God in your own image, is the basic problem the Bible identifies. That's the problem. Like, I know we have many problems in life, but underneath all the problems, we have one basic problem, our tendency to create God in our own image. When Adam and Eve reached out for the fruit of the knowledge of the tree, Adam and Eve were aspiring to create God in their own image. Literally, make God in their own image. They're going to fire God and replace God with themselves. God will now become them and they will become God. Me, God, same thing. That's what the story of Adam and Eve is all about. Displacing God and replacing God with ourselves. And according to the Bible, creating God in my own image, wanting to replace God with myself, meism, is the ultimate source of pain and grief in the world today. Everything can be teased back to that one yearning in us. So when we go about picking little snippets from various religions and putting them together into our own personal religion, what we're most likely doing is creating God in our own image. We're unleashing the instinct that the Bible in the book of Genesis warns us about. And it's this understanding that frames the final verses in the passage Katie read from Paul's first letter to the Thessalonians. Paul says, and I got it on a slide there, Kevin, they tell how you turn to God from idols to serve the living and true God and to wait for his Son from heaven and whom he raised from the dead, Jesus who rescues us from the coming wrath. You know, that term, coming wrath, that kind of sends shivers up many people's spine. You know, in the Bible, idol worship is always seen as another version of meism. Meism is our desire to replace God with ourselves or replace our God with our own understanding of who God is. We've decided to do that, according to the Bible, to our huge detriment. Paul talks about the coming wrath. He's talking about the natural consequences that come to us when we replace God with ourselves. There's no punishment in that statement. It's the inevitable consequence that comes to us when we decide to replace God with ourselves. That's all Paul's talking about. God's going to just step away and let us inherit the fruits of our decision to go it alone. Now, I've got to ahead of myself in a sense. If we go back and look at that list of religions, you can throw that back up there again. Yeah, that one there in that monotheistic bucket, we have a problem, you see, because each of these religions is a very specific flavor, so to speak. Each of them creates a very specific picture of God. Each of them has a very unique interpretation of who God is. And there's no avoiding this. I think many of us wish that we could live at the level of generic belief in God. But that's not going to take anyone very far in this world. You're not going to go very far living at the generic level. It's like eating unflavored ice cream. It's not good. It doesn't taste good. Or we might try to create a composite picture of God by taking little bits from various sources, but that would inevitably lead us back to meism when we do this. It's only when we partake of the flavored theism, when we begin to wrestle with specific forms of theism, it's only when theism comes to us influenced by special or specific revelation that things really start to move for us. Do you see what I'm saying to you? If you're serious about growing spiritually, if you want to grow in your knowledge of who and what God is, you're going to have to move from the generic to the specific manifestation. There's no way of avoiding it. Should answer that. It could be God. Yeah, no, that's okay. Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Sikhism, Baha'ism, Zoroastrianism, they're all revealed religions. They share that one common feature amongst all monotheistic religions. They have one common feature to them. They all believe that a special revelation has been given to them about God. A definite and unique manifestation of what and who God is. The Christian theistic flavor is distinct from the Islamic theistic flavor, which is distinct from the Judaism theistic flavor. But you get my point. There's very distinct manifestations going on here. Let me ask you a question. Where do we get the Christian flavor with respect to God from? Like, where do we get the Christian flavor? Like all other monotheistic religions, Christianity claims that we have a unique revelation given to us about God. A unique manifestation about who God is. Where do we derive the Christian flavor from? That's not a rhetorical question. Where do we get it from? Do you know? I mean, you're partaking of a very unique manifestation of monotheism. Where are you getting the flavor from? Jesus, yeah. Pretty obvious. It's in the name, right? Yeah. It comes from Jesus. Of course it does. The Christian claim is that the Creator God, the one who made this magnificent universe, came to us in a human being named Jesus, Jesus of Nazareth. In Jesus, God reveals to us God's true nature. That is the source of the Christian experience. Without Jesus, we move back into the world of the generic God and all the limitations that come with it. I feel there's a lot of hedging that goes on in a lot of churches about Jesus. I feel it in this church too. This is a magnificent group of people here, but you're still, many of you, hedging in your willingness to follow Jesus. You're hedging on him. I think many of us are fine with the generic God, but we struggle when we have to go into that specific manifestation that comes to us in the revelation that Christianity claims for itself, that God has come to us in Jesus Christ in a definitive and final form for us. As I say, I think many of you are hedging on this, and you're still hoping that we can get by with the generic version of God. With one foot in one camp and one foot in the other, we might be able to get through. We might be able to play out the clock long enough to get through life. When are you going to be ready to put both feet into this specific revelation given to you in Jesus? It's my question to the church. Is it too risky to do, do you think? I guarantee that you would have the same basic problem if you went off and studied Islam or went off and studied Sikhism or Judaism. Whatever you run up against in life, when it comes to God, when it comes to a specific manifestation of God's revelation, it's going to come up to the same challenge for you. We're moving from the generic to the specific. And that can be scary. But here's the problem. I know for myself, at least, I want a powerful faith. I want a faith that can move mountains. I want a faith that can help me get through the dark valleys in life. I want a faith that helps me believe in what I cannot see, helps me touch what I cannot touch, helps me hope in what I cannot yet grasp. That's the kind of faith I want. But I can't get that kind of faith with a generic belief in God. I got to go into the specific beliefs of God that we find in the various monotheistic faiths. And it's not going to happen if I hang on to the sidelines of life and I just hang out there. In this idle world of generic belief in God, it's just not going to happen there. That's why all the churches that have aspired to be places of generic worship are dying away. Nothing happens in those places. For better or for worse, we're going to have to leave our comfortable pew in the comfortable place of following and worshiping a generic God and enter into that specific revelation that comes to us. And meism is not a viable solution either. I can promise you that. It doesn't work. Now, there are many choices out there for you. I won't deny that. And there are some choices that I think are better choices than others. I don't deny that either. But I believe that following Jesus and trusting in what he reveals to us about God, letting his life be a testimony for us about who God is the best choice you could make when you move from the generic to the specific. Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. And then he extended the meaning of neighbor to include everyone. Jesus said that we are to love our enemies and pray for them. We are to bless our enemies, not curse them or persecute them. Jesus said that when someone strikes us on the one cheek, we are to turn the other cheek, not seek to retaliate in kind. Jesus said to us to forgive 7 times 70. Jesus told us that when we've been wronged by people, we must engage in an infinite form of forgiveness. Jesus devoted his life to bring about God's kingdom of love on earth, and he spent much of his time blessing and healing people with various maladies and illnesses. And when his time of trial came, he did not flinch or seek to avoid it, but went to the cross in the face of immense hatred in order to fulfill his Father's holy purpose. And even there, he sought his Father's forgiveness for them who put him on the cross. And then on the third day, Jesus rose from the grave, and he stood before his disciples, and he revealed himself to them, and then eventually he ascended to God. And even there, right now, Jesus is interceding with God on your and my behalf. Jesus sends his Spirit to live awake in us. He promises us that his Spirit can come and live awake in us. And he offers us his power to bless others in life. And someday, he says he will come and bring human history to its completion. This is the specific Christian revelation that comes to us about God in Jesus Christ. Everything we say about God here at Trillium in our bedrock beliefs, every action we celebrate in our core values comes from Jesus. So why are we hedging as a church? When the one who reveals the God of love so perfectly and so powerfully, so clearly, is waiting with open arms for you and me. Why do you hedge? I don't understand. Paul met Jesus on the way to Damascus. Paul was intending to persecute the followers of Jesus. He had an axe to grind with them of a very deep nature. He was going to persecute the church in Damascus, in that city, but he met the Lord along the way. It changed everything for him. And 15 years later, Paul's writing to the Jesus community, to the church in Thessalonica. Paul had brought the Jesus story to these people in word and power. It's no longer in the generic form. We're in a very specific manifestation of theism here. It has power with it. And Paul brings power in his teachings to the people in Thessalonica. And he taught those people about the God who Jesus revealed. And they took it to heart. They accepted this specific revelation. And they became a living witness of what this kind of life looks like when someone devotes themselves to following Jesus. And the people in Thessalonica became a model for believers all over the Eastern Mediterranean Sea, all over the world around the Eastern Mediterranean Sea. Paul says that their faith became known everywhere. And I'm thinking to myself, why couldn't this happen to Trillium? Why couldn't Trillium be like that church 2,000 years ago in Thessalonica? It would just mean that we would have to put aside our hedging, all the hedging that goes on the inside of us. We just have to put it aside. We'd, in a sense, have to renounce our desire to worship the generic God and come and instead worship the God who is revealed to us in Jesus. That's all we have to do to become like the church in Thessalonica. Renounce our desire to worship ourselves and embrace the face of God that Jesus shows us. And trust me, when the face of God that Jesus reveals comes to us, any desire for meism or for the generic life falls away. I promise you that. When the face of God is revealed to you that Jesus shows us, that generic life or the meism of the world falls away. And in that time, we will become a model community that lives out the life of holy love to its fullest completion. So my word to you today is this: stop hedging and start following.